Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
All right, we're going to jump right into this one, Adam. I just hit record.
Yeah. And we just did the whole episode, and then we were like, why didn't we record that?
I know. So I tried right once I recognized we had a discussion. So let me fill in the audience real quick.
How did you know we had a discussion when it started sounding like an argument?
Well, it went back and forth really quick. So one of the things we came up with, you asked me about a formula that I mentioned in the last episode. I call it the success formula. And it's a very basic sample size calculation for a test that if it has no failures. And it's a pretty efficient for designing tests. And then you mentioned this chi-squared formula. So let me go ahead and explain the chi-squared one real quick.
So the chi-squared one. So this is, you know, we were kind of talking about what kind of formulas do you keep memorized and in your pocket to answer common questions regarding sample size and, you know, testing needs. So one, you described the one, the success formula one. And then I said, well, one that I keep in my pocket is based on the chi-squared distribution. And the equation is if people say they know their MTBF goal, but of course the MTBF goal should be the reliability goal. And then you use, you know, exponential distribution to translate it. But it's MTBF equals 2 times the cumulative test time divided by chi-square. And chi-square, you know, takes the input of your percentage confidence and number of failures that occurred. So the numbers I keep kind of in my pocket mentally are that with chi-square, if you have a 90% confidence and you have no failures, that's about 4.6. So the equation becomes quite simply MTBF equals 2 times the cumulative test time divided by 4.6, which is MTBF equals the cumulative test time divided by 2.3. So 2.3 times your MTBF goal is how much cumulative test time you need. So if your MTBF goal was, you know, 100 hours, that's 230 hours of test time you need. If you have...
And that's total test time. So I could take 230 samples and run them for an hour and I'd be done tomorrow. Okay. Or I could take one sample and run it for 230 hours.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. But here's how that I would make sure that didn't occur. I would say with that, what goes with this, if you're going to use a strategy, is it's the assumption that all the failures you're observing are random stress failures. This is not to measure wear out. This is not to measure infant mortality. This is only to measure what kind of sensitivity you have to variabilities in usage. This mm-hmm. is what the question and answer. So what goes mm-hmm. with this is you cannot do this or use this method if you don't already know and have a very specific root cause analysis method for bucketing in the 3 buckets types of failures you observe. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to very clearly bucket what's a quality failure and very clearly bucket what is a wear out failure. And the only failures that count you use in this equation are random stress failures during life.
So what happens if you get a failure that's a wear out failure while you're running this test for the 2.3 times your MTBF right. goal?
You get to use that runtime, but you don't count. You get to use that runtime, and then the unit gets removed and replaced with another unit that has been taken past burn-in. Is the way.
So the failure doesn't count?
The failure, if it's a wear-out failure, does not count. The system wore out. So basically, I'm going with the philosophy here that wear-out failures are predictable failures that are characteristics of the design. And those failures are not a failure in the sense of that it was unexpected. So in other words, if I have...
Wait a minute. Why are we doing this testing then? We're trying to evaluate a slice of types of failures that we yes. already have essentially said are going to occur randomly, right?
Okay. So the reason why we're doing this testing is the question... When I bring this up, I mean, the problem is I'm having to describe the context of when I bring this up.
Okay. Let's back up then. Yeah.
Okay. So, the context of when I bring this up and propose this, or I use it, pull it out of my pocket, so to speak, is I get the question. They say, okay, you know, with our design, we want to know how many units are going to likely fail within, you know, the first 5 years. Our product's meant to go 7, you know, like I get the question.
What's the reliability question? Is 90% of our products going to survive for 5 years? That's the classic question.
Pretty much. Yeah. So what they're asking is, they're saying, if we do other testing and we really understand wear out, okay, and mm-hmm. we understand a normal distribution around it, we know how far it goes out, we know at what time point only 2% of the product will have wear out, and we tell our customer to remove it, you know, before that time, or any failure that occurs there, you know, we should tell them to expect. Okay. So now wear out failures, once they're characterized and you know, they're not asking that question. That's going to be done in separate testing. Mm-hmm. And if they're saying, we understand, you know, we've put in a good HAS or stress screen or whatever, and we understand our quality issues, you know, we're able to screen those and keep those as much as we want to from the customer, what percentage are going to fail during warranty? What should we budget for warranty costs? What mm-hmm. percentage can we say is going to disappoint our customers when they expect it to work and it doesn't? Mm-hmm. You know, if it fails at 7 years, they're not disappointed because we told them to take it out of service in 5 years. So that's the context of the question they're asking. Because reliability during use life is about, you know, measuring the variability. How does your product respond to the variabilities of use, manufacturing, you mm-hmm. know, all these other things, mm-hmm. environment. So that is what this testing is aimed at assisting to answer.
All right. So here's where I see the critical flaws in using that formula. Well, besides MTBF, and people, hopefully the audience understands well my adherence to that metric. But the idea is that once you make that assumption that it's a constant failure rate, the math gets real simple. Right. And I can understand why people pull out the chi-squared, and because it helps explain the concept and explain the balance between, well, here's how much time we need to put units under test, and we can balance that with how many samples we have available, and add more samples, we can get the test done sooner versus later. Right. If we only have one sample, we got to run it for 2.5 times the life of the product or whatever tallies up to our target. That all is great, but what's a failure mechanism that actually precipitates at any point in time, whether quality, useful life, or wear out, that is actually a constant failure rate?
Well, with complex devices, this is how I answer that question. I would never prescribe this if you had a mechanism with that was very simple, had very specific failure modes. Those aren't going to be a constant failure rate. The constant failure rate occurs in a very complex system with a lot of failure modes. And the analogy I use for this is, if you were trying to create a metric for sound, if you just want to create some kind of metric for me, my voice, or me talking, mm-hmm. Decibels wouldn't be very good because I get louder, I get softer, depending on, you know, if I'm excited, da-da-da. There's all kinds of frequency stuff going on. I mean, it would to try to characterize me by decibels would be kind of foolish. You really wouldn't be able to measure me or decipher me versus other people, right?
My Aunt Matilda had a very loud voice, so decimals would work for her.
Decimals, okay. So there's special cases. But here's the thing. What if I asked you to characterize a cocktail party, right? So you have 50 people in a room talking, and you have all those different frequencies, patterns, you know, different distributions of sound.
There's people that do that for restaurants, right? They want a loud restaurant or a quiet restaurant. So, and they measure the decibel level, the sound
exactly,
power.
Exactly. So all of a sudden, something as simple as all those different frequencies happening at the same time level out to about a decibel level. And so let's say your reason for doing it is you want to know at what point the police are going to get called on your party. You know, you can measure the decibel level and say, hey, everybody, let's keep it under 90.
We have to put that in dorm rooms. It's instead of a smoke detector, it's a decibel detector.
Exactly. So now all of a sudden, this very simplistic metric works because the system is so complex. You know, all those complexities laid over each other become this kind of static line of noise. That party, even though all the conversations would be unpredictable and varied, and you couldn't even predict who's going to talk to who or if they're going to talk about politics and start yelling. But the thing is that with all those variables together, you kind of get a static noise, you know? So that's kind of the way I describe it and why it works.
And that argument, I think, starts to hold together for large complex systems like a battleship.
Only. You don't have to go that far.
But it also has to be... repairable, right? So that if a motor fails, we go in and replace it.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. No, a failure. I mean, how you choose to address the failure. I mean, it could be repairable or replaced. You replace it, or, you know,
if the data is really just time to failure, right? If one failure means you failed the mission, the product fails, right? The time to first failure is what I'm really interested in. Because if I put 100 medical devices in the field, and as each of them experiences one failure, that's my time to failure data. And I want to know that 90% will survive 5 years. That's a different question than when I have a repairable system, completely different set of questions. And the non-homogeneous Poisson process and a bunch of other algorithms come into play to calculating that. So reliability of time to first failure is different than the availability of a complex system.
Yeah, there's of course. So again, we should keep this in context. We were talking about a simple way to create a ballpark estimate to answer the question of how many units do I need, how long do I have to test, mm-hmm. And of course, the more detail you go into it, the more complex it gets. So with that factor, I of course only would use this if I wouldn't just say repairable, but if I consider replaceable the same thing. Effectively, you know, you can, you know, swap out a new one. I mean, if a tire blows out on a car, whether you repair that tire or replace it, it's kind of the same thing. You know, you still have the downtime and you still, so, you know, the idea for this to work is that the quantity population that you started measuring has to be the same quantity at the end. So anybody that fails gets replaced.
All right. So I got two thoughts here, Adam, for you. One is, are you familiar with the F-35, the Joint Strike Fighter project? How would you classify
the one that when they finished, they found out that the F-16 had better, still was better and cheaper? No, just kidding.
Well, they found out that they can fly the F-16, where the 35, they have to keep it in the shop and repair it and keep fixing it.
So your question, what's your hypothesis?
They use this premise for their testing, this idea of the chi-squared test program, right? And it at mass, this algorithm, this ability to simplify the answering the question, how many units do I need to test, by assuming the exponential distribution, is really, really convenient. It's in all of the statistics books on reliability engineering. And it tends to completely mask what you're really doing the testing for. Right.
Yeah.
And so there's one issue with that. Just because of the calculations, it makes it very, very difficult to find the issues that you're really interested in. And then second, let's say the tire goes flat. And let's say I really, really want to pass this test that we don't have flat tires over the 20,000 miles that we want it to last. Right. And so I say, well, how many units do I need to test? The failure mechanism is puncture. Well, a smart engineer is going to look at it and go, when the tread is new, it is less likely to be punctured than when it's old. So let's put in more tires and run them for shorter durations over the testing for puncture. And we'll have an improved chance of actually passing this test. Because if you look closely enough, tire puncture, while often used as a symbol for a random event, a nail on the road, still has a physical change in probability of causing a flat. A brand new tire in great condition, inflated properly, is less likely to be punctured than a worn out tire near the end of its life, according to the wear mechanism. So use that and extrapolate it for just about any failure mechanism. There are random strikes, and I agree. But if I had 8 small lightning strikes, the fifth, you know, the 10th one doesn't have to be huge to cause the failure, because there's accumulated damages that occur. So you got to look at it in detail. And I think the grand gesture to move away from or to assume the exponential distribution is really, really damaging to that argument of, well, how many units do I need? I tend to recommend two things. One, focus on what's the failure mechanisms. What is it we're trying to evaluate? Is there accumulated damage? Do the fans clog with dust and debris? And does that change our ability to cool the system? Go down that fault tree analysis, what can cause our failures, and make sure the testing addresses those items, right? and then back out what's important for sample size. And the second part is that I think there's a couple different levels of testing in answering this question about how many units do I need. So for the wear out mechanisms in characterization type work, if we really want to know when the increase in failure rate starts to occur, then it's a life study, right? And it has its own algorithms for determining sample size. But if it's in that, what we're going to, I'm going to use air quotes here, Adam, is in the useful life period, because I firmly believe that period actually doesn't exist. There's a decreasing failure chance of failures from broken components and pieces and latent defects. And there's things that can happen during installation. And then there's the onset of wear out and all the different things that can cause failures. And granted, there are events that like a drop or a lightning strike that can occur fairly randomly, depending on what part of the world you're in and what kind of protection it's in. But there's three kinds. One is, well, how robust is my product? We often call that environmental testing, right? So let's put it at high temperatures, put it at low temperatures. Let's run it through a series of environmental stresses and just see if it works. Well, that's not necessarily a reliability test. It's a robustness test. And they obviously overlap, though, with, well, where's the stress lead to failure? Then there's reliability testing. How do these stresses manifest into a time to failure, right? And that's not an exponential distribution, vast majority of the times. And then there's, what are the things that we don't know yet, right? How else can this product fail? So the halt and margin testing kinds of experiences go after looking for failure mechanisms. And so to answer the question of how many units do I need, my first answer almost always is more than you're willing to give me, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And by dropping in on the exponential is you're really evaluating a very small corner case of what anybody's interested in. It to get at the answer of how many units you need.
I feel like everything you said, though, what I said is not conflicting, because you went against some of the initial assumptions that I had that took me to the answer I had, right? So your first example with the tire and puncture tire, that's one very specific failure mechanism, you know, very specific conditions. That's not going to be exponential, as you described exactly. I would not suggest, you know, the method I did. But if you ask me, hey, Adam, really quick, how many cars do you think we need to figure out ballpark how many customers come back in the warranty period, you know, and they're talking about literally 2,000 failure modes. Mm-hmm. I might do that, you know, door handles breaking, alternator belts, you know, like,
right,
you know,
right. All that. Yeah. I think
the F-30, but your F-35 thing, that was just lazy. I mean, with something like a system like that, if in an initial business conversation, you could do that. But then to truly just limit your testing modeling to that was just foolish.
Well, I was in the contract, you know, set 20 years ago. So it was all based on chi-squared. And so why not use what I call the success formula, which helps you get around this notion of the constant failure rate.
Tell me about how it was derived. I want to hear a little more about how this was derived and the assumptions that go into it.
All right. So it's the basic idea is, this is one where I'll put a link in here to the blog the post article that actually shows the derivation and where it came from. But in summary, it's basically if you use the binomial distribution, right? And it's, and say, how many samples do I need if I stress my product for the equivalent of a lifetime? So like cars, right? They run them on test tracks. They run them through, I don't know if they do it anymore, but they take out vehicles and run them pretty hard through all kinds of different environments and situations, trying to rack up enough vehicles with enough equivalent to a lifetime of driving. So like if, for me, my car gets like on the order of 10 to 15,000 miles a year. I don't drive a whole lot since I work at home. And so they estimate what's a typical year of driving for a person, and it might be 100,000 miles over the expected lifetime of a car. So they'll take a number of vehicles and go run them for 100,000 miles in all kinds of different conditions. But the question is, well, how many vehicles, just as you phrased? Well, it's not as simple as if I ran one car for 500,000 miles, that's equivalent to 5 years. So if I run 20 cars for 50,000 miles or whatever the math comes out to, it's not the total number of miles that really matters. It's the amount of stress that replicates what a car would see over a year, over a lifetime.
But for what you just said, that also would violate into why I would not advise what I advised, because you can't experience quality or wear out failure modes. So you can't have one car run, run 500,000 miles.
Right. So I agree, you're limiting where you would apply this thing. But so the success formula is based on the binomial distribution. If I can run, how many vehicles do I need to run for a lifetime in order to make an estimate as to what its reliability is going to be? Now, if we make the assumption that the test will have no failures, and that's why I call it the success formula, and it's often used, it generates the magic numbers that you see in standards, like 7 samples or 77 samples or 30 samples are all based on some combination of confidence that your sample represents the population and a threshold defect level or reliability that you're looking for. And so I use the sample size equals the natural log of 1 minus the confidence, confidence being the type 1 error, the chance that my sample represents the population. And 1 minus confidence is alpha, so if you're more comfortable with alpha, you can do that, divided by the natural log of the reliability. And there's a second factor in denominator is the bottom part, right? My third grade teacher is going to roll over, roll her eyes at me, is the lifetimes. So if I'm going to apply stress to an item, and I can do an accelerated test so that in a couple of weeks, I can replicate, say, 5 years of stress to this product, M would be 1 if I stop the test after it's received a year's or a lifetime worth of stress. So a car tire, we typically say it's at 20,000 miles, 30,000 miles, whatever, some number like that is the expected life due to tread wear would limit the life of that product. So we need it to run for 20,000 miles, for example. And so if I run the tires for 20,000 miles, that's equivalent to 1 lifetime. And so and if I can run it for more than that, there's a limit to how far you can go beyond a single lifetime. But the idea is I'm measuring that tail distribution of what's the reliability I'm interested in. And so what I pull out of my pocket when I need to answer this question is, well, let's say we can evaluate our product for a lifetime. We can accelerate it. We can put it through its paces or whatever. If it's run 24/7, then we got to get more creative of how we apply the stresses. And I want a 90% confidence of a 90% reliability is the at least 90% reliability. If it has a 10% defect rate over our lifetime, well, that's too bad. We need to detect that. That's not acceptable. So that's how you set the reliability numbers. What level of detection do you really need? And then I need to run 22 samples in that condition set for a set of stresses that replicate a year of stress or a lifetime of stress, I should say. And the 22 samples are running in parallel. They don't get stacked in time as the chi-squared distribution does. Right? So it goes directly at how many samples do I need to run, and it adds in the variability of, well, can I accelerate it or not? Can I? What's my statistical confidence of my sample versus population? The risk I'm taking that my sample is going to give me an answer about the population. And what's my threshold of detection I'm looking for? How bad does it need to be before I care, for example? Yep. And sure, if you want 99% reliability and you want very high confidence and you can't accelerate the product at all, you're going to need thousands of samples.
Yeah.
Right? And none of them fail, because the chance of something failing over a short duration of time is much, much different than over a long period of time.
Yep.
Right? And so the chi-squared assumes that same phenomena occurs. The chance of failing per hour is constant. right? So this success formula works if it actually is a constant failure rate, but it gets rid of the memoryless feature of that algorithm. So it will tell you you need a few more samples than the chi-squared was. Now, chi-squared may be so popular because it has that cool Greek character in it, and it really gives you a very minimal number of samples. And I argue that just because it came out of that formula, I think the assumptions that allow you to get an answer out of that are so misleading for the way normal products operate that it sets a lower bar and expectation that, oh, we only need 10 samples.
Yep.
And at the end of the day, you run 10 samples, nothing fails. And what have you really learned? You know, we've got a 30% confidence that it'll last for 6 months. Okay. Mm-hmm. Is that really good enough for you to make a decision?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So I push back on the chi-squared pretty hard, as you can tell. And
well, I would say you've broadened my perspective on this with this conversation.
Yeah. So we'll have to put in some notes on more about the chi-squared formula. And with a big caveat, as a listener, please never use it.
Never. No, I won't go that far.
Yeah, I will.
Never use it. Okay. But I would say not say never use it, but I would say it gets a bad name because it's not used within the right constraints and, you know, assumptions and boundaries of the way it should be used, which is very easy to do.
All right. Without a carte blanche assumption that you have a constant failure rate, has anybody found, let's ask the listeners, have you found and justified the appropriate use of the chi-squared sample size calculation? Right? Is there a case, and I'm not aware of any, is there a case, let me know, and of where it really does work? That, and you know, let's hear that story. Now, on the other side of this thing, there's probably plenty of stories where you run a chi-squared formula, or you run a number of testing, you make some broad assumptions, or you're limited by sample size, you only get two samples and do the best you can. And then you're either pleasantly surprised the product works or you're not. I'm sure there's plenty of stories out there on those parts too. So let's open it up, Adam. Let's say what, and there's probably other ways to do this, to answer that question of how many units do I need to test? And let's open that up and see what kind of comments and feedback we get.
Sounds good.
All right.
Put it to a vote.
That's right. We could do that. We could put a survey on this and the notes. I don't know how much traffic we get to it, but easier would be is if you want to chime in on this, and I know it's a topic we all face as reliability professionals, is, well, how many samples do I need? Is go to reliability.fm up, and under the Speaking of Reliability series, you'll find comments fields and suggestion boxes. Plus, if you dig a little bit on the site under the About page, you'll find Adam and I and the other hosts of the show and our contacts capability. So let us know. What is your thought on how do you help people understand quickly, right? Something you walk around with and can explain to people. Well, here's why we need 8 bazillion samples or not. You know, how many samples do I need ballpark? Is that fair, Adam? We'll leave it at
Sounds
that.
Sounds good. Sounds fair. All right. Democratic.
Okay. And we got great listeners. Some of the most intelligent people in the world listen to this podcast. I'm a firm believer of that.
That's what I hear.
All right. Thanks, Adam. Talk to you later.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.